Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths, the program that is devoted to those of you who have come to the realization that all human institutions are corrupt, whether they be religious, political, military, or economic, and that there is no salvaging them. They are rotten to the core. They are actually against the interests of the people that they claim to be protecting. If you're open to that realization or have come to that conclusion, join us. If you would like to defend a political or religious institution or a military one, have at it. You're welcome to try to challenge what we have to say. Our number, if you'd like to join us either way, toll free, 877-300-7645. We have Kirk with us, and as our custom on Friday, since we have IQ al-Rasuli in the second hour, we're going to begin by talking about those things that are actually trustworthy, productive, beneficial. Hey, Kirk, you're a bit of a historian, correct?
Oh, well, I read a lot.
Okay. What is the most well-read, most popular, most copied historical it's a portrait of history. Let's call it the most popular text written prior to the conversion from BCE to CE. What is the most popular story, the most popular text in ancient history?
Well, I doubt it would be the Torah because so few people read it. So it has to be the Greek. What's the?
Homer wrote it.
Homer.
The Odyssey.
And the Odyssey.
Right. Yeah, the Odyssey is vastly more popular than the Iliad, but correct, it is the Odyssey, and it ain't even close. Now, in terms of just ancient manuscripts available to us today, prior to the transition from BCE to CE, it really is the Torah. There are more copies of the Torah and prophets and Psalms than there is anything else in terms of surviving text, because they were so well protected and because particularly of the Dead Sea Scrolls. But overall, throughout the world, the most popular text of all time is the Odyssey. Is the Odyssey a true story?
No.
Okay. What if I were to tell you that I really believe the Odyssey?
So you're welcome to believe your belief, but you'd be disappointed.
No matter how, what if I were to able to convince 51% of the world to believe that the Odyssey is a true story?
Well, they say 40 million Frenchmen can't be wrong, but they can.
So you're telling me that the Odyssey, even though it's enormously popular, the most popular text in the ancient world, that and it claims that Odysseus, he is known as Ulysses in Roman mythology, but Ulysses, Odysseus in the original Greek text, was not engaged in a discussion with Athena and Zeus about his fate.
So he could talk to the gods.
Just because he claims he was talking to the gods. So doesn't that mean that there's a case to be made for a goddess named Athena and a god named Zeus?
Well, according to the Greeks.
How about they were talking about Odysseus's enemy, the god of the sea, Poseidon.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, everybody was absent at this moment from Mount Olympus. So why is it that it's not credible, it's not wise, it's not informed or rational to believe the Odyssey when it speaks of these gods and goddesses and is so enormously popular?
Well, in our culture, we believe it is a fable, but I'm sure somebody may have taught it and thought it serious at times.
But, the whole story is about miraculous things that happen and interactions with gods and goddesses along the way.
But you can't prove them.
Well, actually, you can prove they didn't exist.
Well, that's what I mean. But you can't prove that these things, these events happened,
mm-mm,
like prophecy and the Torah.
But it comes from a book that isn't nearly as popular, that is historically accurate,
mm-hmm,
the Iliad.
Right.
So the fact that it's written by the same fella, and is based upon a historical book that is historically accurate, the Iliad. Why shouldn't we, by association, believe this New Testament isn't accurate? Why wouldn't it be accurate if it's based on the Old Testament of the Iliad and it's historically truthful?
Well, if it was based on it, then it would be exactly the same, wouldn't it? It would have a little more information in it, but it would
the characters
contradict it.
Yeah, the characters and their interactions would be the same. But in this case, one of the characters emerges from the Iliad, only one, and that one character now engages with all manner of false gods.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds a lot like the Christian Old Testament, which is historically true, and having one character out of it all of a sudden be painted into a scene of mythology engaging with false gods. It sounds like the same thing to me.
Oh, well, you know, that's very good.
But if someone were to challenge you when you say, listen, it is absolutely impossible. There is a 0% possibility, zero, that the Christian New Testament is the inerrant word of God.
Right.
Now, you'd have the vast majority of Christians have a conniption fit. And then when you say, but I believe it to be so, and you say, it doesn't matter if 3 billion people believe it to be so.
No.
It's absolutely ignorant and irrational to believe that the Christian New Testament is the inerrant word of God.
Yeah, well, how do you deal with the fact that the minute it was the King James, for instance, is published, they come out with scholars in Cambridge that have immediately 30,000 errors.
Well, yeah, there's 30,000 errors.
The first year of his publication, well, the guy over in Cambridge is at the University of Oxford in Oxford at Cambridge is doing this.
Yeah, Mills, what he found actually is there's 30,000 known discrepancies between 12th century
and
manuscripts and the Textus Receptus.
Yeah,
the number of errors between the 12th century manuscripts and the King James would be 10 times that amount.
Oh, yeah.
As a matter of fact, what we've found now, since we have unearthed so many 1st, 2nd, and 3rd century, 69 of them, as a matter of fact, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd century, early 4th century manuscripts of the witness writings, as well as the poison pen of Paul, that collectively we have found that there are over 300,000 changes over the years between those documents and the Nestle-Aland, which now represents the basis of most English translations. Mm-hmm. If you've got 300,000 variants and 180,000 words,
all right,
one would be sufficient to tell you, well, it's not inerrant. 10 would be a concern. 100 would be serious. 1,000 would be a horrific problem, 10,000 catastrophic, 100,000 overwhelming.
Tear it up.
300,000 known variants?
Yeah.
Among 180,000 words, disregarded.
Yeah.
But it's certainly not inerrant. But if they say, but, you know, look how many people believe it to be so, just because you don't think it's so, you know, I'm not going to accept your position. It's the same as the Odyssey, isn't it?
Absolutely. Sure.
And they would say, well, you know, it was all the characters and all the events were predicted in the Old Testament, giving it credibility. It's the fulfillment of the Old Testament. And they'd say, well, the same thing was true between the Iliad and the Odyssey. Doesn't make the Odyssey true, does it?
No.
Odyssey was really popular. Still didn't make it true.
No.
Popular. The places, the places described in the Odyssey actually exist. Still doesn't make it true, does it?
No.
They actually got Odysseus's name right. Well, they didn't get Yosha's name right. Still doesn't make it true, does it?
No. Well, that's the beauty of twisting, though. You have to have some truth. I mean, it tells a much better story if you can name some places and times and things going on.
But it was popular because not only was it an entertaining story, but because there was a shred of truth into it. But if you're an artist, if you were to draw a $100 bill, and get 99% of the strokes right on your depiction of a $100 bill.
I can fool a lot of folks.
Does that, you could fool a lot of folks, but what would the value of that bill actually be?
Well, it wouldn't be worth anything.
Yeah, it would actually get you in trouble, wouldn't
well,
it?
Well, I was going to say, once I get caught, it's going to be.
Yeah, it has a negative value, which is the exact same thing as the Christian New Testament, because it has so many counterfeit strokes, it actually, rather than being worthless, it's counterproductive. We have Glenn with us. What do you think, Glenn, about the comparison between the Iliad and the Odyssey?
Well, in terms of Homer, it's not that unusual for one author to dabble in both fiction and nonfiction.
No, it isn't. Yeah.
Relatively common occurrence even today.
Yeah, I know a guy that has written some 15 books, and the second book that he wrote was the only one that he wrote that was nonfiction. Oh, excuse me, that was fiction. It was fiction. All the rest were nonfiction.
Well, and in terms of gods being fictional, the atheists often capitalize upon this in their line of argumentation. They'll say, well, we readily agree with you that all of these gods, these other gods, are fictional. We just want to add one more god to the list, yours.
Yeah.
They do that apologetically all the time.
Correct. Oh, yeah. If you want to be part of our religion, no problem. We want you to be part of it, because then we'll have control over you. We'll be able to fleece you. We'll be able to influence you. You'll empower us. Our power base grows. And if all we have to do is incorporate your god and goddesses and your religious festivals and rites and doctrine into it, no problem. Makes us more popular.
You mean the atheists as a religion? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, it's whether it's atheism or Christianity, that's how Christianity was formed.
Church, yeah.
Well, yeah. And atheism really has incorporated, hook, line, and sinker, the ancient earth, wind, and fire, Mother Earth religious doctrines. I mean, the oldest of all pagan doctrines, which in essence worshipped the earth and the things of the earth. I mean, that is kind of the heart and soul of socialist secular environmentalism today. And they're inseparable.
Don't be picking on Earth, Wind, and Fire. They had some great tunes.
Yes, they did. But they weren't gods.
Oh, well.
And that is the point. No matter how much secular humanists want you to believe that we belong to the Earth, it is not true. That was actually the single most common criticism that I received after having written and published Yada Yah and then questioning Paul, was the Christian complaint was that they could not even fathom the idea that I could be right and that over a billion Christians and billions of Christians over time could all be wrong. It's the same argument of the Iliad versus the Odyssey, isn't it? And so what do you do under those circumstances? All you've got is evidence and reason. You can reveal to people the horrible condition of the text, 300,000 known errors, differences between the oldest versions and the basis of modern translations. And that is before you get to the translation errors, which add hundreds of thousands more variances, that it isn't even remotely accurate. Now what? Now what? You've got contradictions in the stories. You've got the most quoted story, he who has no sin cast the first stone, and forgiving the adulterous woman and writing something in the dirt and saying, your accusers have gone, then, I also forgive you. And yet it didn't occur. Now, every copy, thousands upon thousands prior to the 7th century, skip over that whole thing. Go from the end of the 7th chapter of Yahochan and John into the 13th verse of the 8th chapter of Yahochan and John. It was added 800 years later. It's just not credible. And then you've got half of it written by a man who is obviously lying, who acknowledges being demon-possessed, who tells us bluntly that he's insane. reveals that he is a murderer and that he's a sexual pervert in his letters. And throughout his letters, his primary premise is to contradict God. He claims he speaks for Yahusha and yet never quotes him accurately. Only attempts to quote him once, and that was out of context and errant. Horribly errant. So what are you left with? This notion that God can't be trusted, so that he chose Paul to come up with an entirely different plan that contradicts everything that he had previously promised? You know, Kirk, a similar story to this would be the story that exists in the Quran, where the Quran claims that it's an Abrahamic religion and names Abraham and Yishak and Ishmael, even names Dod, David, wrongly names Yahusha, calls him Esau, which is the name for the one person God called out by name to say that he hates.
Love of the prophets.
Yeah, and then it claims that it's the inspired by the same God who inspired the Torah, and yet twists and perverts the Torah's presentation and the prophet's presentation of these people's lives such that it bears no resemblance to the actual person. So why would anybody in their right mind believe it's true? You know, the Christian presentation of Jesus bears absolutely no resemblance to the actual individual.
No. Well, I used to say when I was a Christian, to other Christians, I'd say, you know, that everywhere he went, he argues with and shows his dislike for religious people. So why do you want to be religious?
Right. In fact, he even shows his disdain for crowds. Every time there was a crowd, what did he do? He walked away. Walked away, tried to actually sneak away where no one would find him. And what he wanted to do was just spend quality time with the 12 fellows that he chose.
Yeah, family.
Doesn't that tell you a lot about, family. Doesn't that tell you a lot about God's interest? I don't want to be surrounded by a gazillion people with all sorts of selfish ideas and selfish interests. With all sorts of corrupt ideas, I just want to go away with my friends. But isn't that profound that he would constantly walk away from the crowds to spend time with talking with his disciples, teaching his disciples, those who were open to him, who really wanted to learn from him?
Don't sound like a politician, does it?
No, it doesn't sound like a religious leader that would draw millions of people and relish it. You know, no matter what way you look, he's the antithesis of how he is portrayed in religious circles. We'll be back in a moment. Why is it that 99.9999% of Muslims and Christians, both of whose religion claims that the Torah was inspired by their God, those who claim that they have been saved by their God, those who pray regularly to their God, don't trust their God when he issued an invitation for them to meet with him 7 times a year, and they just don't show up? Why do they ignore each and every invitation to be called out and to meet with God? Why is that, Kirk?
Well, the preachers tell them it's not important. And then they have to do something else to make it, give them something else to do.
Like, why would you trust the preacher over God?
Well, I've learned to be...
Why would anyone do that?
I've learned not to, but sometimes you just fall for the old lie.
The Pope claims that he's representing God.
Right.
If he's representing God, why didn't he show up for Yom Kippurim? Why didn't he answer the invitation for Sukkah? Why didn't he advise all Roman Catholics to do the same?
Well, you have to conclude that his God doesn't require that. then you ask, who is your God?
Yeah, who is your God? Because it's Yahweh that says, if you don't, I'm going to tell you, I'm inviting you, and it's a free will. Mm-hmm. You get to choose, but you need to know the consequences. It's like anything else that you have a free will over. If I have free will as to whether or not I'm going to join the military and then sacrifice myself on the battlefield trying to block machine gun fire because I really like the guy that's standing behind me. That's my free will. I made that choice, but there's a consequence, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
They're going to send me home in a body bag.
That's right. You're dead.
Yeah, dead. So in the case of Yahweh's invitations, you can attend or ignore them or reject them. But if you reject them or ignore them, there is a consequence.
Yeah. Your life is over.
Right. You know, with Yom Kippurim, God said, you're going to be outside the family, estranged from the family. There's only one family. That's the covenant. And you're going to be cut off, banished, ceasing to exist. Dead. Gone. No more.
Serious stuff.
Serious stuff. I mean, he's saying, you know, it's not what I want for you. But, you know, if you're going to ignore my invitation to live with me, to be perfected by me, to be empowered by me, to be enriched by me, to be reconciled to me, if you're going to ignore those things, this is the consequence. So here we go. It's these godly and specific appointed and designated meeting times, moed. Now, if you see, you just came across the word moed.
Mm-hmm.
And you were following Yahweh's instructions and you were observant. Wouldn't you want to look up moed just to get a sense of what the word means and how it was used in context? When was the first time that Yahweh used the word moed in his testimony to us?
In Genesis.
Yeah. In fact, first chapter, right?
Mm-hmm.
He called the fourth day. He said the fourth day was a sign of the greater light for the purpose of the moed. Well, a sign, greater light, moed. Isn't he talking about these meetings?
Mm-hmm.
This is a sign. In fact, if you want to get right down to it, the fourth day speaks of the fourth millennium of human history outside the Garden of Eden. It's the first four moed were fulfilled in year 4000 Yah,
mm-hmm.
which was 33 CE in our pagan calendars with Pesach, Matzah, Bikurim, and Shavuot. These are the last three moed, with Sukkah being the last of them, seven of seven. And so Yahweh defines what moed is. It's a meeting, appointed meeting, designated by the authority. So you think that God set up a meeting. You know, I've worked for people, and I've worked with people, and I've owned my own businesses.
Sure.
When I worked for people and the boss set up a meeting,
you show up.
I showed up 100% of the time. If I called a meeting when I was the boss, those people who kept their jobs, they showed up 100% of the time. If you're doing anything that's important with somebody, particularly if you respect the individual that you're associated with or you're benefiting in some way from that person, and they call a meeting, you show up. But this just happens to be God. You know, this whole gig is his.
Mm-hmm. Well, think of the nature of the meetings, though. I mean,
the first meeting here is for him to make the sacrifice personally required to make you immortal. I think I'd show up for that. I mean, that's like bonus day, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like the ultimate bonus days. And the second, now you don't need to show up, maybe, but I do because I'm really flawed. And so the second one is now that I'm immortal, it would be really good to be perfected, because to be immortal and imperfect would mean I'd be eternally separated from God. That doesn't sound like a fun time. That would be Sheol.
No.
So the second meeting makes a flawed guy like me perfect.
Right.
And what do I have to do other than show up?
What exactly are you doing to help this?
Other than
showing up.
Yeah, well, I'm making sure that the bread that I eat does not have yeast, so that symbolically I understand that the fungus of yeast, it represents religious and political rebellion against God.
But you're not making a sacrifice. You're participating, but
I really like yeast. I really like yeast.
Well,
I am doing something that is depriving me of something that I enjoy.
Well,
I happen to enjoy, you know, the level of the sacrifice for 1 week of ridding my diet of yeast is de minimis compared to the gain. But I've at least done something.
Okay.
Now,
fair.
You know, I provide for my family and myself and barbecue lamb. Provide a fine bottle of red wine, and I provide unyeasted bread, bitter herbs, dipping in olive oil on Pesach. I'm making a contribution.
Yeah.
I'm showing up with something.
You brought something to the party.
I brought something to the party. Now I'm going to eat what I brought.
Yeah.
You know? So it's not much of a sacrifice.
You're going to drink some of that wine, aren't you?
I am. But I've made a contribution to the party. And so the first two, you'd think you'd show up. Now, the third one, I guess you would have to know who you're being adopted to. I've been around a lot of really wonderful characters and a lot of not-so-wonderful characters. There's some people I don't want to be associated with. And I have, particularly in business, man, I've run into people I don't want to be associated with. And I've met people historically. Like, if I were to be adopted by the Obaminator, I'm going to pass.
Mm-hmm.
You know, adoption is only good as the individual whose family you're being adopted into. You know, I'm going to pass. If Merkel said, you know, adopt you into my family, I got, you know, a good gig here going to Germany.
Yeah.
I'm going to pass. You know? Hitler was a pretty lonely guy. What if he had even said, I'll adopt you into my family? And he had lots of fun toys. You know, I'm going to pass.
Mm.
So, you know, the bottom line is adoption is a good thing if you like and you're comfortable with and you respect the person who's adopting you and if you want to spend a lot of time with them. But that's the third meeting, is to be adopted. And the fourth meeting, boy, that's bonus time.
Mm-hmm.
You show up at the fourth meeting. And as a beneficiary of the first third, you're now adopted into God's family, and it's all about, well, the bonus is enrichment and enlightenment, empowerment. That works for me. And, you know, the fourth meeting, the fifth meeting, well, it's, you know, a lot of people would think that since you're not given eternal life, you're not given perfection, you're not adopted into Yahweh's family, you're not enriched and empowered, that the fifth meeting can't be as much fun. Yet it's my favorite. Teruah. Because on Teruah, you're empowered to do what is the most fun.
To use your knowledge.
Yeah, to use your knowledge to share what Yahweh has shared with us.
Mm-hmm.
To encourage other people to consider what he has to offer. To warn people that just because your religion is popular, just because lots of people believe it, doesn't make that odyssey true.
No.
We have Wayne on the line calling in from the state of Texas. And he's got a question on the time of the Moeds. Hello, Wayne. Hello, Wayne. You're on. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was curious about this timing of the Moeds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you were saying, boss calls a meeting, you show up.
Correct.
You have to show up on his time.
Correct.
So where in Scripture do I find the instructions to formulate this lunar calendar?
Oh, it's really simple. I mean, it uses the term Kadosh, which is the Hebrew word for month and moon, and the verbal root to renew, to describe the basis of his timing. And throughout Leviticus, as he's presenting, which would be Kata, as he's presenting these seven meetings, he tells you specifically that they are based upon the first and the seventh renewal of the light on the moon's surface. So that's pretty straightforward. Second,
well, no, It doesn't really say that, though. If you look at Genesis 1:14,
yes, it does. Yes, it does. No, I mean, you can no. Well, then you're not asking a question. You called to make a statement, but they all do. And for example, this one. Let's just shut this down because we had a person who wanted to make their own statement. But here, and Yahweh spoke to Moshe for the purpose of saying, converse with the children of Yisrael on the 15th day of the 7th month. What is the basis of month? Kirk, are you familiar with that word, month? Wayne here doesn't seem to know it. What is the basis of the word month?
15th day of the month is Kodesh.
Kodesh, yes. And Kodesh is based upon what Hebrew verb? Kadosh. Kadosh.
Oh, Kadosh, okay.
Yeah, and Kadosh means renewal, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Renewal of the moon, yeah.
Yeah. So in Hebrew, the word for month is based upon the Hebrew word for renewal. And so all you got to do is consider the meaning of the word, and you know that this is the 7th renewal of the light on the moon's surface. Now, how would we then go about determining the first month of the year? So, well, I mean, the 7th is pretty straightforward, the 7th time that light is renewed on the moon's surface. But so let's help Wayne out here. Wayne doesn't think that it says this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Does Yahweh explain what was prevalent during the first month during the Exodus? Does he give you any indication about the environment, what you would see at the time of the first month?
Well, it's the barley.
Oh, yeah, he calls it a beeb, doesn't it? Yeah, he calls it a beeb, which means that the barley ear is green and still growing, and barley is the first grain to sprout a kernel in the spring. When does that occur for the most part around the world?
Well, March, April.
Yeah, right around the equinox is when that occurs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then does he also tell us about the spring blooming of a plant that would happen to be the flax?
Mm-hmm.
So right there in Exodus, as you're transitioning out of Exodus, names, Shemoth, into Korah, Leviticus, he's telling you that the timing of the first Passover was a beeb.
Yeah.
When the barley grain is green and growing, there's a reason that he chose that time, by the way, and also when the flax has that blue flower. The blue flower is synonymous with not only royalty, but with the heavens. And the flax is the purity of the flax speaks of a white garment that is woven from something that is alive and living. And the Aviv, the kernel of barley is always the reference to a saved soul.
Yeah.
And it's green and growing, which means it's receptive, growing, living.
Yes.
Right? So God's very specific about the time, and then he tells you on that first month, which is Aviv, count 14 days.
Mm-hmm.
So how is this difficult? What part of this?
It's easier. I grant it's easier for farmers and people who are agricultural because they live with this every day than us city dwellers. But you can certainly it's not that hard if you look at the words real close. I mean, you know, say, okay.
You know, I don't give rabbis much credit for many things. Mm-hmm. One of the things that they figured out is that you don't have to be a farmer to figure this out. You know, the timing of barley is consistently right around the equinox, and all you have to do is take the first renewal of the moon's light closest to the equinox, and that's all you need to do.
Yeah.
Now, is there the possibility that one year out of every 10 or so, that there may be two renewals of the moon's light very close, equally close, you know, 2 weeks away? Both of them, one 14 days away, one 15 days away, because the moon phase is 29 and a half days. Is there the possibility that every 10 to 20 years or so that you might pick the wrong renewal of the moon's light?
Well, I think Terry sent your email asking about, like, 2016.
Yeah. Yeah, 2016 is one of those. Yeah, 2016 is one of those where you've got a one that's 14 days and one that's 15 days away.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it's possible that you could we could goof and get that one wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible that because Yahweh doesn't give definite instructions on the conditions required for this Kadash, the renewal of the moon's light, is it possible that you and I could come up with a different night to celebrate Pesach or Matzah?
Sure. We could be off a day or two.
Yeah, we could. Yeah, we could be. Yeah. In fact, there was a lot of people that celebrated Teruah as well as Kippurim and Sukkah a day earlier than I did.
I'm a day earlier on Sukkah than you were. I was doing astronomy just because I have it in my book.
And so here's the difference. Yahweh doesn't. All he tells us is Kadash, which means renewal. So it has to be at a time when the moon's light is renewing on the sun. The reflected light on the moon is renewing. But there are a lot of things that go into to that calculus. For example, in our world today, the day lasts until midnight. But the day in the Hebrew began at sundown and ended at sundown. So because of that instruction, if light begins to renew on the moon's surface, but only after sunset, you know, if the sun has already gone down before the renewal occurs, even though technically that's the astronomical count in today's parlance, I won't count it because it's inconsistent with the day from a Hebrew, a Torah perspective. So I only will count an astronomical too thin to observe physically if the light is renews on the moon's surface before the sun has set. Now, is there a specific instruction on that? Nope. But can you make the connection between things and say, yeah, that seems like that's reasonable?
That's fair. Yeah.
That's fair. So you can be off by a day, and the realization that you can be off by a day, I think, is by design. Because you can't make a religion out of it. You know, you can't be someone that says, well, I know for certain, and I can take, you know, this or that reason, and I can state it for certain while those who I think are really open-minded and rational about the evidence will say, you know, I'm not going to go to the mat and say I'm absolutely certain. I'll say, here's the evidence, here's the thinking. You know, you decide. Think it through.
Well, the worst-case scenario, you could celebrate 2 days in a row, you know.
Yes, you can. In fact, Yahweh doesn't mind
Hezekiah,
that. Because,
Hezekiah.
Yeah, the Hezekiah example is to go on with it. Glenn, you've called back.
Yeah, I heard that caller. I kind of wish you had given him a little more of a chance to voice his objection, because I think you could have probably refuted and corrected him fairly easily. Like, as it stands, it makes it look, you know, he's saying, yes, he's afraid of me, you know, he didn't even let me get my, you know, he started to quote something from Genesis, and you know, we're talking about the way the things are laid out in Leviticus. I think it would, you know, it would be relatively easy to,
Let me tell you why I shut him down. I shut him down because, twice he says, no, that's not what it says. So he is at that point making a statement that is untrue. Not what it says. That is what it says. And so I went right back to the first introduction here of Asuka. And Asuka, that's exactly what it says. So, you know, I'm not going to allow somebody to say, no, that's not what God says, when that's, in fact, what God says. Now, if he wanted to make a point from Genesis, then if he had taken the approach of, okay, granted, I understand that's what it says there, but that seems to be contradicted by, or is there's an interesting angle that you may want to consider in Genesis, I would have let him make his Genesis presentation.
As a novice, and as someone who doesn't really know much about this yet, I want to make a point about how people learn things. Because you're saying it's not like it's simple. And actually, like, I think of the various things you know, that you learn. Like, okay, so just, first of all, I happen to think calendrical study is actually in something somewhat inherently complex and that sort of thing. Most people don't even know what a lunar calendar is.
Oh, by the way, I agree with you. I think this is complicated. I don't think it's simple.
Right.
I think that I think if you take your time and work yourself through it, if you are observant and open-minded and informed and rational, that ultimately you don't have to be the sharpest tool in the shed to get it. But I would never claim it's simple. I think it's fairly easy, but only easy if you dedicate the time to it.
Well, yeah, but then you also, it's a matter of, and it's also repetition in learning. For example, when you're learning to play the piano, if you play scales, if I'm learning the months of the year as a child, I'm going January, February, March. If I'm learning a phonetic alphabet, I'm going to Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta, Foxtrot. You know, repeat these things. If I'm learning the trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, you know, you've got to work through things and repeat them.
Agreed.
I don't even know all the names. Like, I've not sat down to do my calendrical studies, but I can't rattle off the months in Hebrew. I can rattle off, but all this stuff requires, you have to have the resources in front of you, you have to read them, then you have to repeat them and memorize them.
Well, actually, you know what's interesting about the months in Hebrew? It's the same thing with the days in Hebrew. The days of the week in Hebrew are just numbers.
Numbers.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So that's pretty easy in the days of the week. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Shabbat is just 7. In terms of the month of the years, the first month has a name, but after that, they're just numbers.
Right.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and sometimes 13. Pardon? Other than knowing the Hebrew word for 7 and probably for 1, each odd, you don't need to know them.